Well, here I am again. But anyway, it's a pretty good wall there from a fighter pilot standpoint, because we have a nice dry bed at night. Food's not too bad, and it's pretty nice living for wartime. You better watch that that flying bell. They'll have to recall you and get you over here. You and Wilson Hurley and me be too much in one war, I'm afraid. Today I went down near the Nha Trang to bomb what they call a suspected enemy assembly area. The clouds were real low, and FAC wasn't going to let us go in at first because he didn't think we could hack it, but we talked him into it, and it wasn't too bad. We made 3 passes apiece and dropped 4 750-pound high-drag bombs, and really did enjoy it. It was a tough target because the weather was real low, and it was in a valley between 2 huge mountain ranges, and the clouds were laying all down in the valley, and the tops of the mountains were obscured with clouds, and there was just one little entrance so we could keep the target in sight and roll in from. And of course we had to use afterburner all the way around to keep our airspeed up because we couldn't dive. And we'd go through this one little old window, make an abrupt left turn, roll out, and put the pepper on, and when you get so close to the ground it scares you, you pickle a bomb and then pull up abruptly. And by pulling off straight ahead, you're below both mountain ridges there, and you just fly and fly until you get to the end, and then you pull right straight up. And the spacing was just about right. Of course, we were almost straight up going into the clouds and recovering on instruments, and with a hard left turn on top, and you'd break out. We'd break out upside down, and with another left turn onto a downwind, looking for our window to go back in again. It's one of those targets where it really presents a challenge, and to hit it is a real satisfying task. But we did pretty good. The friendlies were all around, and they were giving us yellow and green smoke. And so there was really no worry about them, but they had some airplanes on right behind us, and so we had to get out, didn't get to shoot the guns down there. So we headed up toward Phuket because they've had a lot of real good fighting up there, up in the Song Bong area. And we were up holding. There was a 2 F-4s dropping bombs and napalm up there, and then there were 2 100s ahead of us that were trying to get on and strafe this target. They had 2 battalions of NVA up there, and the Army had 1 full battalion that was in close contact with them, and they were marking with smoke and everything else, and everybody was yelling and screaming that they were getting hit, and they needed air, all they could get. And later on, a number of more airplanes rendezvoused up there, and looked like the sky was black with fighters trying to get in on the target. But right in the middle of the whole thing, one of the F-4s mistook the friendly smoke for the white phosphorus rocket that the FAC had fired to mark the target with. And he rolled in and dropped 2 750-pound bombs right in the middle of this battalion friendly forces. And boy, when he did that, the war stopped, I guarantee you. The Army commander really did scream on the radio. Everybody was high and dry, all switches off, and while they fell back and regrouped, and the forward air controller, I thought, was going to cut his throat right there. He really was excited, and he was yelling, and sounded like nothing you ever, sounded like those Sand Tank and his death song. You can imagine what he was like just before old John Charlton shot him. But that's what it was like. And as a result, when the smoke cleared and everybody got through crying, why, they sent everybody home. No more ordnance expended. By this time, the enemy was really chopping them up, and they didn't know whether to run or sit down and wait or what to do. But when we got back, the whole world knew about it, and the poor old boy that dropped those two bombs is probably in San Diego, heading east on a donkey by now. It's not funny at all when you have what we call a short round. A short round is one that you drop on friendlies or strafe friendlies. The only two things we worry about over here really are dropping on friendlies, and it's really tough sometimes. It takes guts, boy, I guarantee you. The enemy doesn't bother us, but it takes guts to roll in and drop a 750-pound bomb when the friendlies have troops in close contact, knowing that unless it's a perfect bomb, you're going to blow up your own forces. And if killing a bunch of GIs is not bad enough, your whole career is gone. You fly no more, and everything's down a drain. So that's what takes courage over here. The other thing we worry about are low blows. A low blow is where you press the parameters of your bomb fragments and fly through your own blast, and of course, in doing so, you blow your own airplane out of the sky. It just happened to me one time, and I took just a minor hit. But it's not too uncommon to have airplanes come back with fuel tanks blown off and that sort of thing. Not only do we worry about low blows, but we've got what we call a high blow, where you're too close behind the man in front of you that dropped a big bomb, and his fragments blow up in the air maybe 1,500 feet, and you catch one of them coming down when you run through on your pass, and it hits you on the top rather than blowing into you from the bottom. So you need to stay 40 seconds behind the man in front of you, minimum. That coupled with the bad weather and the visibility over here, and usually around 4 miles, and haze caused by all these farmers burning their dried rice, hemp, and pulp. And the Army choppers are every place over here. There was one day last week up in the Ashaw Valley where the Army lost 26 helicopters in one day. And this is within a 25-mile area up there. Those that weren't shot down, which was probably two-thirds of them, ran together in the air. And it was just unbelievable, the amount of air traffic up in there. And they have very little respect for a fighter coming through with four bombs and 500 knots. The closer they can come to you, the better they like it. Those grunts are something that I'll never understand in a million years. I've got a friend over at Phu Hep, which is the Army station just immediately south of here. He lives with the battalion commander over there. And a battalion, I think, is something like 800 troops. 600 to 800, and he's an intelligence officer, a captain, and the battalion commander is a colonel, and they've got the only wooden floor in their tent in the whole battalion, if you can believe that. And they are really uptown, the head niggas. Old John washes his face and shaves every morning out of an aluminum bed pan that he found someplace, and he pours his water out of a GI 5-gallon can. His bed consists of a real thin mattress about an inch and a half thick that he rolls up every morning, and at night he unrolls it on his cot. He doesn't have a pillow. He's got no sheets and no blankets. He does have a mosquito net, and that consists of their home, a tent, It opens on both ends, and you can't stand up, but right down the center where the pole's holding the darn canvas away from your head. And they've got all kinds of stuff laying in there. There's, I think I counted about 8 or 10 homemade Viet Cong hand grenades laying around on the ground and on their eating tables and in the chairs. There's a hand grenade laying there, and AK-47s and K-44s and all kinds of portable machine guns on tripods and that sort of stuff that they've captured from Charlie around the area here. And if they're not miserable, they're not happy. They, their latrine consists of one of those regular GI issued things that they pour coal oil in every day and set fire to. And their shower, of course, is nothing but what you saw in World War II, where they hoist a can up with perforated all up and down both sides, and you got about a 75-second shower there. Of course, the water's never heated or anything, and they eat almost exclusively sea rations. The only thing that guy's got over there that's worth having is a Jeep. I'll never understand the Army, but they're just as happy as bumblebees. The sand is so thick, you can't drive through it any place unless you've got four-wheel drive. You know how that sand does when you drive tanks over it all the time? It's like cement. And if you wear a watch over there, you're going to ruin it. Every base up and down the countryside last night was hit. Ben Tui got hit once yesterday afternoon and once again real early this morning. Of course, Nha Trang and Phan Rang and Phuket and Phu Hep and Pleiku and Kon Tum and Binh Hoa, Cam Ranh Bay, and all of them were martyred last night. Tui Hoa South, which is where I'm stationed here, is the only base in Southeast Asia that wasn't martyred last night. Why they haven't wiped this place out is something that nobody can answer. The province chief here is Lieutenant Colonel Ba, B-A, and he's just been recently promoted to full colonel, and the way you get promoted is to buy your promotion. You take graft up and down the countryside from everybody until you've got the right amount of money. Then you go down to Saigon and you pay those people and you get a promotion. Then when you get promoted, you start drawing more money from the government, and so with just a small kickback every month from that, you're X number of dollars ahead each month, and this is a measurement of your success as a military leader. But old Ba is, Ba is his name, is considered probably the best province chief in all of Vietnam. At least that's the reputation that he has. When you live over about 3 months over here, that means you've got things pretty much under control. And it may be that he's keeping the enemy from bombing this place. We did take 82-millimeter mortars about a week ago in our bomb dump, although there was zero damage done. It was just enough excitement at 1:30 in the morning to make everybody run to the bunkers. Harassment more than anything. But at least it keeps us from getting bored over here. I still haven't been close enough to a martyr that I could say for sure that these guys are really trying to get me. I've seen them land a quarter of a mile away, but I don't know what's going on. I'm looking forward to getting away from here for 8 days. I'm leaving here on the 16th to go to Cam Ranh Bay, and I'll get on an airliner with round-eyed stewardesses on the 17th. On my way to Darwin and Sydney. And boy, I am really looking forward to some time off. I've been over here well over 4 months now, and I haven't had so much as a half a day off since I've been here that you reach a point of non-productivity, and that point was saturated about a month ago for me. I'm a walking zombie. So I'm going to go down there and really enjoy myself. If I can get the right kind of setup, I don't know whether I told you this or not, but I want to get back in the bush, back 300 or 400 or 500 miles away from the nearest town, and stay with some of those old farmers and ranchers back there. The R&R Center down there has a number of these guys lined up that are really interested in having Americans come spend 3 or 4 days with them. And I think that would be a tremendous way to get out in the countryside and rest. What I want to do is get out amongst the Aborigines down there and see what they're like. Maybe I'll bring a blowgun or something back. You may remember me talking about the Special Forces camp at Kunsan, which is the place I went down to. They'd killed the two tigers and had skin stretched on the roof down there where I got my crossbow from the mountain yard. They were hit real hard 2 nights ago, and the next morning there were just stragglers hanging on there from the mortar attack, and the enemy was in close proximity all completely around them. And we lost a number of scrambled airplanes down there and just bombed and strafed and napalmed the heck out of that place. And they took 27 wounded and killed. I don't know how many of them later died, but they had to evacuate 27, I think, out of 33 that they had down there. And they really got hit hard. It looks like intelligence build up here, or at least intelligence tells us that there's a big build up coming, perhaps another offensive, and it's somehow related, I'm sure, to the peace talks. But these VC have a tremendous capability to communicate. Nobody knows how they do it, but all these different bases will come under mortar attack at exactly the same second. They're not even a minute apart. And how they communicate without us being able to find out is really something our intelligence people would like to know. We could take a lot of lessons from these guys. Tremendous courage these Viet Cong have. Doesn't anybody that operates over here very long doubt the courage of these people? And you can absolutely just saturation bomb them, and unbelievably hard. I remember one time up in the Ashaw Valley, we had 6 airplanes in one flight, and each one of us had either 4 750-pound bombs or 4 napalms, and we saw a bunch of VC run into an area, either Viet Cong or NVA. The forward air controller saw them running into one small little area, and I saw myself and 2 other pilots saw them running, and we saw exactly where they went. And this guy in front of me rolled in and dropped a bomb where he thought they were, and it was confirmed by everybody else in the flight. And we expended all of our ordnance in that one little area, trees, not too big. There were some bunkers in there, but we dropped 24 weapons in the 750-pound class in that one little area. And then we strafed 800 rounds of 20-millimeter high explosive apiece and left. And when we were leaving, the forward air controller called us and said that there were 6 of them were up and walking down the middle of the road. And it was unbelievable. But in the first place, that they had lived through it. And in the second place, that they had the gall to get up and walk down the street. while we were still there. Nobody had any ammo left. So the FAC just called in more airstrikes, and they pounded them again, and I have no reason to believe that they killed them, but those people must just disappear. They dig these bunkers so fast that they look like a badger or something going in. And unless you hit them, you're not going to kill them. We need some big bombs over here if we're going to hit these bunkers. We need 3,000-pound bombs. It's tough if you're delivering a bomb 30 degrees a dive. It's just going to make an 18-foot crater, which means you've got to drop it within 9 feet of the bunker in order to hit it, and you just can't drop them. If you drop it within 50 feet of where you want it, from dropping from 3,000 feet, and I'm talking about a low-drag bomb, you just can't hit those things. Of course, you're giving them a nosebleed, I'm sure, and they're not going to hear for another 6 months. But tremendous endurance and courage those people have. They operate on almost no food at all. The food that they have to scrounge or steal or take off somebody, because they're not given any food whatsoever by their own army. Their weapons, they have resupply on it, but the rains come and go over here like the wind in Lubbock there, and the hardship is something these people don't know. It'll rain on them, and they treat it like it's not even raining. And they'll attack a base in a suicide mission. They must know that it's a suicide, because we'll launch airplanes and we'll know exactly where maybe 100 or 150 of them are. And when we get through with them, we'll go in there, and they'll count 150 bodies in just case after case after case. And surely these people, with their communications that they have, they know that this is going to happen to them, and yet it just doesn't seem to make any difference to them. When we take prisoners, which is every chance that they get, he will just freely tell you anything that he knows. He just tells you everything that you want to know about his outfit, which leads people to believe that they're not really soldiers. It's just a way of life for them. They'd just soon fight for us, you know. If they get caught, why, just give him an M16 and point him the other way, and he'll fight for you. Trouble is that you just can't trust him. You don't know when he's going to go back again, depending on who may give him the best or largest bowl of rice, or who threatens him the most. But every one of these guys is a soldier of fortune. The flying over here is really great. It's the greatest experience of my life. The countryside is absolutely beautiful. Large waterfalls that are falling 150 and 200 feet, and I swear you can see them 150 miles away when you're climbing out to go to a target. The tall jungle is the most intriguing thing that I've ever seen in my life. The elephants and tigers and leopards in there, and of course there's cobra and all kinds of snakes. But when you get out in it, now I've never been out in the jungle over here, but the same thing is substantially true over in the Philippines. It's the most beautiful thing you ever saw. There are beautiful big orchids growing every place. The bamboo stands are the most beautiful you ever saw, and you can take, there are big vines hanging maybe 300 feet from the top of a big water tree, and these vines are maybe 2 inches in diameter, and they never vary in size all the way up to the top. And you can cut one of these vines off with a machete or a bolo, maybe cut you a piece 3 feet long, and hold it up to your mouth, and it'll pour a pint of water just as fast as it can run out. The whole thing will pour out in 2 minutes' time, a pint of water. And there's absolutely no dying of thirst over here in this jungle, I guarantee you. And there's so many different types of food. Banana trees are every place. And it's just an ideal place to live, really. The monsoon season brings a lot of rain. And the primary jungle is just like you see in the old Tarzan movies. I sure wish I had about 1,000 acres of this tall jungle back on the outskirts of Lubbock there someplace. Well, I've been rattling on here for much more time than I'm authorized, I'm sure. You've probably turned this off and gone to work 3 or 4 different days before you had time to finish it. But I thought I'd take a little time and say something to you, because you've been so nice in sending me tapes the last couple of weeks. I've been over here a little over 4 months now, and that's a little over 33% of my tour. I'm hoping to get home for Christmas. The rule over here now is that you can't go home earlier than 3 days before your year is up. However, I understand at Christmas time they make an exception and they try to get you home for for Christmas, at least by Christmas Eve, if you departed the States after the 20th of the month. So we'll wait and see how that turns out. But the time is passing fast, and I don't mind it too much. I'm getting a little bit used to it now. The main thing is missing the family, of course, the kids, and it really makes me homesick to hear you talk about going down to Camp Cooper and all those different places, and just reinforces an opinion I've had for some time, that old life gets shorter, boy, with every passing day. And every Saturday or Sunday there, where we laid around the house thinking about going someplace without doing it, is another one of those days that'll never drag its dusty feet down your trail again. And I know when you're laying on your deathbed, you're going to say, son of a gun, I sure wish I'd gone to Camp Cooper on that time I was thinking about it. But with that little bit of philosophy, Bill, I'm sure I appreciate it more over here than you do over there, but I'm sure nevertheless that it's true. And you just can't afford to let a day or a minute or a second go by without getting the absolute maximum that you can from it. And with that in mind, why, I'll close this thing off until the next time, and hope that you and your family are in good health and your ears perked up and your feet warm and thinking about all the things we're going to do when I get back, and all the Indian ruins we're going to dig. I've still got to take you over to Fence Lake and show you those beautiful pueblos over there. Old Lonnie and I went over there and really had a ball. Say, I got a letter from Dennis the other day, and I'll send it to you, because I doubt very seriously if you'll ever hear from him. He hates to write worse than anything. But you got to read this letter. He went back to Avondale there and started finding pots so fast that you wouldn't even believe it. I'll send this letter to you. And you might even let James read it if he's interested, or Lonnie, because Lonnie, you talk about Indian ruins and he'll jump up and down. This thing's about over, Bill, so tell the wife and Zvi Kleiner Kinder hello for me, and Wiedersehen.